Welcome, sound aficionados, to Southern View Sound and Music's podcast series, Studio V. Mr. V, Paul Vastola, will be exploring sound and music with an emphasis on the grand piano and people who know and appreciate this amazing instrument. Today, Paul is visiting Lisa Downing, an accomplished composer, entrepreneur, and international touring concert pianist. Lisa is a multi-Emmy Award winner for her compositions which accompany documentaries featuring exceptional Colorado women. She and Paul have collaborated on a number of recordings which have been featured on solo piano playlists of a number of music streaming services. Let's join them now.
So I'm here with Lisa Downing, one of my great, great friends, and that is for sure. And we have been listening to a piece called Postludium, performed by Lisa, and off of her album called The Wisdom of My Shadow, captured by me in 2016 at Rocky Mountain Recorders. I'm going to start by asking you how we began working together.
Oh, man. Let's see. It seems like it was my second and third albums, and I was getting ready to do a concert series in New Mexico, so I had to get out new material, like, fast, and it had to be, one of them had to be Christmas, and so we tried to knock out two CDs simultaneously, which I will never do again. That's a bad idea. But you were great, you know, and we got a lot done. We got them both done before the gigs, and it was wonderful. But I can't remember how. Oh, it was from Mindy. It was from Mindy Sterling. That's how we met.
Mindy's in the pivot on a lot of stuff, isn't she?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I want to ask you what your early history with the piano was.
Early, okay. How far back do we want to go?
Well, childhood.
Like, okay, so not like pre-life or reincarnated stuff. Okay, so my earliest memory of the piano, I was a year and a half old, and we were at my at some friends of my parents' house, and they happened to have this little spinet in their dining room. And I think I was, you know, pretty much pre-verbal. I mean, I talked really early and stuff, but I remember they had older kids, and I walked up to this piano, not knowing what it was, reaching up above my head and pressing the keys, and it made a sound, and it was like, oh, man, I was just completely fascinated, and I was like looking around for these other kids that could tell me more or help me with this or somebody. And I was looking around, and pretty soon my dad came, and I remember him feeling him pick me up, and he took me out of the room and turned the light off in the dining room. And I was like, what? There's a magic thing in there. I couldn't imagine why everyone wasn't just in there just fascinated by this thing. And that's my earliest memory.
You have an interesting story about your first piano.
Well, yeah, it wasn't exactly a piano,
sure,
though, right? It was, I loved the piano so much, and I wanted to have a piano, but my parents, you know, didn't have enough money to buy a piano, and so I was always forever trying to create something. So my dad was a pharmacist, and he owned this pharmacy, and he'd come home with empty cigar boxes, and she would string rubber bands on these cigar boxes, and I would play music from that, but that wasn't satisfactory. So I remember making a piano out of cardboard, which is less than satisfactory in terms of resulting music, but it was cool because I, you know, took time to figure out, you know, how the keys were made and how many black keys and white keys and stuff like that, you know.
So did you draw them on this cardboard?
With a marker. I sure did.
Too much. This is a famous story of Lisa Downing.
Oh, God.
Well, what inspired you musically early on?
You know, I had songs that I liked. By the time we actually got a piano, see, my dad, he rented an organ first because that's what they could afford. It was this monthly rent, right? But he didn't realize that just because an organ has keys that look like a piano, it's not a piano. But still, it was, you know, I could learn some stuff, and it was fun. And there were songs in a book that, you know, that I didn't love. And I was always looking for those pop songs. But the first song I ever played, I think, was Windy.
The Association.
Yeah. That one. And Aquarius was the next one. But I couldn't read the music.
Did you take lessons?
I didn't take lessons until I was like 12, maybe. I thought that I knew how to figure it out myself. Right. And I told my parents, you know, because they could see that I was playing by ear. And my dad thought that was a miracle and that I was so gifted and stuff. And so that kind of fueled my ego. And I was like, yeah, you know, I don't need lessons. I can do this. Well, I taught myself how to do a lot of stuff. And then I had to spend 10 years unlearning all the stuff I taught myself.
Did you have a great teacher, an inspiring teacher?
You know, there were two piano teachers in my neighborhood. And one was the good piano teacher, and one was the B class piano teacher. And I got but the great teacher was always full. So I got the B class teacher. And, you know, I didn't learn a whole lot from her, but it was something. And I was doing piano lessons and still not learning how to read. So I'd have her play something for me, and then I would play it back, right?
As you grew up, did you get involved with bands?
I did. Actually, I started a band. Back in a previous life, I was a youth pastor at a Christian church, and I started a band called Wings of Faith, and it was for this youth group called Fellowship of Active Christian Teens, FACT. And I thought they should have their own private worship tunes, because they're teenagers and they want their own stuff, right? So I wrote songs for them. I wrote 20 songs for them. And I got people in the band, and we toured and did, you know, youth group things all over the state.
You never cease to amaze me with your woman power. Because, you know, weren't bands a very guy thing?
Is it?
Yeah. Well, weren't they in our kind of the Beatles on up, you know, it was the guys wanted to be in the bands to attract the girls.
Right.
So the girls weren't in the bands. They were mostly watching the bands, but you were.
Right.
Made the band.
I made the band. I did.
That's cool. So did you make a career out of this? How did you make a living early in your adult life?
So I went to college. And while I was in college, I did like temp work, so secretary work. And my mom especially always said that, you know, typing was the thing that I could fall back on. So I spent a lot of time typing, and it was a kinetically kind of similar-ish kind of thing. So I kind of liked that feeling of typing. And I spent a lot of time learning how to type fast. And so I was doing all kinds of stuff like that. After I graduated from music school at Metro, I worked at Rose Hospital. I was an EMG technician, and I did medical transcriptions for a while until one of my patients, she was a piano teacher, and she had carpal tunnel syndrome, and they did surgery for it, which I had it eventually too, and learned not to have surgery because then her hand was paralyzed. So she couldn't play, she couldn't teach, and she gave me all of her students.
And so you became an instructor at that time.
I did.
Way back.
And I took on these students, and I thought, this is like vacation, because there's people coming and they sitting here learning how to play the piano, and they leave checks on my coffee table, and I'm like, this is heaven. I'm not going back.
Well, I also did teach some very young people at the music store.
Oh.
And I found that was very easy because we're starting at 101. We're starting John Schaum Piano Book 1, you know, and Crunchy Flakes and, you know, that stuff. Right. And that was very easy. I certainly couldn't have taught anyone intermediate or advanced, though.
Well, you know, it took me a while to get there, and I thought that I was going to have to take somebody in a half an hour at their first lesson from middle C to triads. So I finally learned how to adjust, and I learned how to specialize in teaching people that played by ear and not do the things that my teachers did play for me so that I could hear it and play it back. It's like, oh, no. Yeah, you're talking to somebody who knows what you're doing.
You wised up.
I did.
Yeah. What about the composing that you currently do? What started you out on that track?
Well, I always kind of was doing it, but the first song that is actually on my first album that I would consider professional grade was born out of tragedy. I was pregnant with twins, and I lost them both. I had a miscarriage I had appendicitis, and the emotional fallout from that was, like, unimaginable. Especially at the time, I was 22 when that happened, and nobody could understand. You know, none of my friends had been pregnant really, or you know, had something like this happen, and so I felt really isolated. And the only way I could express myself was at the piano, and I wrote the song "Twins," that is on my first album.
Well, I've always known that you write from your heart and from your life experiences. Yeah. Let's talk about some of your compositions.
Okay.
I want you to select a piece for me that accurately represents the Lisa Downing piano technique.
Holy moly. And oh, then, yeah, they all kind of do. You know,
well,
I mean, they
all. I want to play that piece.
Well, then I guess I'm going to go with Diaphanous Breeze. And that, interestingly enough, wasn't from sort of a life experience, emotional kind of place, which most of my pieces sort of are. This was about me sitting in this house, as a matter of fact, in my office downstairs, and the cottonwood seeds were blowing past my office window. And I was watching that, and I could hear the music in my head that went with what I was seeing outside my office window. And so my husband came in, and we were watching it together, and he was saying that the word diaphanous perfectly described what we were watching. And yes, it did. You know, just it was, because it was one of those years where the cottonwood seeds were like snow. I mean, it was like a blizzard. It was really cool. But and I often hear music ahead of playing on the piano. It was just in my head.
Well, Diaphanous Breeze is kind of the trademark piece that I associate with you, so I'm thrilled to play that for our listeners.
Thank you.
You know, this is about pianos and composers and players. So I want to talk a little bit about the instrument.
Okay.
You and I both have a fascination for it anyway. I'm fascinated with the grand piano as it's an amazingly complex device. What's your relationship with the instrument itself?
You know, like when I saw the piano when I was a year and a half old, it was an instant attraction, this magnetic thing, just this almost an obsession with it. Like anything that I would see that had three blacks and four, you know what I mean? Just anything that even remotely looked like a piano keyboard and some, you know, just like, oh, I had to be near it, by it. And a grand piano, I mean, my piano right now, I own a Yamaha C6. And it really is my dream piano. I would own a C7 if my house was big enough, but we decided that we didn't want to add on to the house so it would fit. But it's hard to explain.
I like to stand over it and smell it and
look
up and down the strings and dust it, you know, and love it.
Yes.
I'm sure you've played a lot of pianos.
I have.
What ones have really knocked you out?
There's a couple. I played in Estonia for a concert that I did with my son probably 20 years ago that Joe Onofrio donated to, I was doing a fundraiser for an assisted living facility, and we were trying to raise money so they could buy a piano that worked. And he donated this 9-foot Estonia specifically for this event. And it was like it played itself. It was just an amazing instrument. And I don't know if all Estonias are like that, but that one certainly was.
Awesome. Well, you know, my first love for an instrument came from playing a Steinway D. So I think this 9-foot piano really has something that gets into your soul, and you're just like, oh my God, this is makes me feel like I can actually do something good here, right?
Right.
You are a Yamaha artist.
I wish I was. I consider myself to be. I'm not sure they do.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what does that mean to be a Yamaha artist? Should you become? Haven't you applied?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Big time. And many people have. And they've kind of in a holding pattern with their artist series right now. They had some tragedies happen at Yamaha with the people that worked in that department. And so there's not much going on there for anybody else but, you know, Elton and Alicia. And I think that more than what they could do for me these days, because it used to be a different gig, you know, they would help find you concerts and do some promotion for you, but there's not really much of any of that. In this day and age, being a Yamaha artist is more about marketing Yamaha, me marketing Yamaha and getting out there and talking about the instrument that I love so much, and I do.
I had a question here for you, but it's about pianos that you have played.
Yeah.
Now, you've been churches, schools, concert halls. Any anecdotes about something that particularly stuck out? Clunker?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many of those. Two very similar ones, but, well, we'll talk about the grand piano. And I won't say the place where it was. But it was also a Yamaha, very old Yamaha. And I was rehearsing for a gig that I was playing that evening. I was the only one in the room. Pete was with me, my husband, and, you know, because he's the tour manager, and he was in some other room, and I'm playing this piano, and the left leg gives out. And I'm holding this grand piano up, yelling for somebody to please help me because I'm trapped now by this piano.
Well, it was in your lap, I guess.
It was.
You are a recording artist. I would like you to talk a little bit about your recording career.
Let's see. My very first album, Think on These Things, really, it was my very first experience, so I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know, and it was to tape, right? It wasn't digital. So there was no editing, really. I mean, there could have been, but it was just too hard. So I had to play from beginning to end the song.
Yeah.
And so there were many takes to make that happen. Fun experience, loved it. And then I met you. And you are the entirety of the rest of my recording career.
Well, I guess that's a short answer. Do you have any suggestions for people who are contemplating making a recording?
Gosh, you know, I mean, besides just being prepared when you go in, you have to sort of know yourself. And a lot of people can just go in and knock out a whole album. And I'm not a person that can do that. That isn't the way that I work. I can do about 3 songs. And then I have to go and finish composing the next 3 songs and do those. And then go finish recording the next 3 songs. And if I'm doing a 12-song album, that's quite a process. But I know that about myself. And so I guess it's about knowing how you work and your workflow.
After you and I began recording together, I think we've done 3 records.
Mm-hmm.
I became a big fan of yours.
Aww.
I've recorded many artists and, you know, players of all levels. Once in a while, I'll become kind of enamored with one. And I was with you because you were just so good and special and the music was different. And I went to a number of your performances. You were at churches, a concert series where there would be several artists playing.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a little bit protective of you. I don't know, you might not even know this.
I don't think I did.
And I wanted to be sure that the pianos that you were playing were in good shape and that you were going to sound as good as you could.
Oh.
You know, I want to hover to the point where it's ideal. And I felt that way about your piano concerts. I'd arrive before the gig, maybe 15 minutes, and I'd go over to the piano and I'd look for a bad key, or I'd check the tuning, or if there was a buzz or a clunky and something, I would go, I wonder if there's something we could do about that. And then if there were microphones on it for sound reinforcement, I'd jiggle those around and try and get everything ideal for you. And then I'd go sit down and watch the concert.
I never knew you did that. You're going to make me cry. How sweet that is. Thank you.
When it comes to the studio, you were very particular about the piano, and I learned so much working with the instrument with you. We had the technician in. If there was something that was buzzing, we would point that out. We kind of drove the technicians crazy to a certain extent.
I'm sure.
Well, when Reed would say to me, who are you recording today? I go, Lisa. Oh, okay, I better, you know, I'll stay while she gets here. So, you know, if she has any issues, we can operate on them then. Because the last thing he wants us to do is call him up and say, hey, we're here, we're playing, we got a weird noise, it's clunking. And so technically, I got a lot of great experience through helping your piano sound its best. We fussed over the voicing, the tuning, the nuances of the pedal sounds. Did we talk about going with shoes off?
And yes, we did.
Yeah. And yes, did you end up going with your shoes?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, you realize how much movement there is in these works. Right. All those dampers clunking down on the strings. And, you know, we're like, whoa, what is that? It's like elephants. And so we had to deal with that stuff. And I was wondering if you were dialed in on that stuff as much as I was.
Yeah. I mean, maybe in different ways, different aspects of it. But yes, I was very, because, you know, it's my stuff and I want it to sound amazing.
There's no masking.
No.
Going on with other instruments playing or singers singing. So that thing is out there in space by itself.
Right.
You've had performances with a number of artists. Liz Story.
Mm-hmm.
Suzanne Ciani.
Yeah.
Who I have admired since she was a synthesizer specialist.
And still is.
Is she really?
Oh, yeah.
But I felt that your music was among the best. It was a new age genre that you guys were working in,
mm-hmm.
but your stuff didn't quite sit in that new age, as I call it, the arpeggio noodling, you know, world. It was very fresh, and I think that was one of the things I really enjoyed about when you were part of the concert. To me, something changed when you came up and played.
Huh.
Tell us just a little bit about what it was like touring and doing concerts with those ladies.
Well, and them, and not only them, but David Lawns, Peter Cater, you know, my idols. And I remember being in Spain with David Lawns and finishing my set. And then he was the headliner, right? And being in the wings and just all of a sudden it just hit me. What is my life? I'm performing on stage in Spain with David Lawns. How is this even a thing? Sometimes I don't know that I was actually connected and conscious with it in the moment. You know, I was so nervous and focused and, you know, trying not to mess up and look stupid and, you know, that I didn't really appreciate the gravity of it.
Right. I mean, you may be so internalizing what's going on that you didn't quite experience the experience.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Wow.
That's
exactly. And you're an international touring artist.
I am.
Yeah. give me just a few highlights of places you've toured to.
Oh, well, let's see. So I mentioned Spain. Let's see. We've been to Argentina. That was some. Oh, those were some of my favorite concerts. With Julio Mazziotti, and he also just an international superstar pianist. And I was always so intimidated by him because, and without reason, because he's just this super nice guy that, you know, after years of touring with him, was just, you know, one of my best friends. And he doesn't speak English. We don't speak Spanish. So we're using Google Translate to have this relationship live and in person, right? But we were in Mendoza, his hometown, in this beautiful opera theater that was renovated. So it had like four levels, like an opera theater, right? And the piano, beautiful Steinway. And I got to play that and just, and it was always full. In Argentina, they had life-size posters of us. You know, they took our promo pictures and made life-size posters of us all over town, lighted and everything. And it was like, again, what is even happening here?
Yeah, they treated you like a celebrity.
Oh, God. They did. It was wonderful.
I've always recognized you as a very highly self-motivated artist and entrepreneur. You ultimately formed your own business, Vision Quest Entertainment.
Sure.
Give me a little background on that and what it's doing.
That started, I was still teaching piano, and I was trying to develop a new income stream. But I was performing, you know, at hotels and country clubs and stuff, and I started to get more requests than I could fill in terms of performing. So I started to get my college friends sort of involved. And then I started to realize that if I stood in the middle of the purchaser and the artist, well, there was money to be made there. And so I started doing that. But in addition, I'm looking for a name for this business now. I didn't have a name for it before that. But my ultimate goal was to send a demo to Windham Hill, to Will Ackerman, and become a concert pianist. And so I named the company Vision Quest Entertainment because I was on a quest for that vision. And the talent agency was financing that for me.
You mentioned Will Ackerman, and that wasn't going to be part of my questions here, but you did get an opportunity to work with him.
I did.
And you went to his place?
I did. I went to Imaginary Road Studios, and he has a little Steinway that all the, you know, famous Windham Hill pianists played on, but I didn't connect with the piano. And nothing against the piano or the studio. It's all wonderful, and so many famous people have played that piano, but I didn't connect with that piano. And not only that, but to what I was speaking to before, I couldn't go to Vermont and have 12 songs ready to play and knock it all out. You know, I had to have somebody locally, like you, to be able to nurse it sort of along,
right,
you know,
right.
And nice guy. And I got to perform with him too. I performed with him at the Kate Theater.
While you were out there working on your recordings?
No. So this was a whole different tour thing. And the cool thing was, is that I had been all these years chasing Will so that I could work for him, and he ended up working for me.
Okay. So you might have loved it to have gotten on the Windham Hill label.
I would. Oh, that was huge. Yeah, I really wanted that. By the time I got ready to do that, Windham Hill didn't exist anymore. You know?
And it doesn't now, huh?
It doesn't. It exists as Imaginary Roads Recording Studios, but it's not a record label anymore.
Tell me what the marketing techniques that you're using now and how you expose listeners to your music and sell your records.
You know, the whole process changes so much and so quickly, and it's so hard to keep up with. By the time I figured out how to apply to Pandora with my first well, with the second and third albums, you know, we did it wrong, right? So then we missed that whole boat. And so to try in subsequent years to get those two albums on Pandora has been a challenge. But since Pandora, then there's, you know, the Spotify's and the Amazon's and the iTunes and all of the stuff that sprung up in terms of streaming income. And so that's how I get most of my royalties. But really it's about, I think, because I don't really know, but what I think is that it's about seeking out people who are creating playlists, so influencers on those platforms, to get your songs on there so that, you know, their audiences listen to you. But, I mean, there's also just social media and stuff. I try to post on Facebook and Twitter. And
good luck selling a CD anymore.
It's true. It's all about streaming.
I've given people CDs, or I'll say, can you take a CD? And they'll go, oh, I think I might have a player in the truck.
Yeah.
That's it. It's sad. And the fact that there's no packaging really with the streaming stuff to where people can read about you and who you are and where you did this and, you know, what
the songs are about.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And with you, what the songs are about is so crucial. It's so central to, you know, the feeling that you put into your music.
Yeah. I miss that.
Well, on another hand, you are piling up awards left and right. And I'm always so impressed.
Oh.
And following, you know, your posts and stuff. Okay, she's playing here now. And these people are recognizing her talent. And she's with this group. And I don't know if you and I chatted about this, but I thought it was a great idea for you to be involved with women's groups that either have awards or they're recognizing women who have done work that's outside of the normal, you know, women's endeavors. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about, you know, how you've connected up with that.
Boy, well, there's several organizations, and I have been involved with the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame for several years, and I got involved with them through a friend of mine. Her name is Jill Teigen, and she was the president of the National Women's Hall of Fame. And so we created some events and concerts, you know, to support the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame. And through that, I met their videographer, the people that they like to use, and photographer. And they filmed the first concert I did for them. And then they told me, he goes, you know, we can submit this for an Emmy. I'm like, you can? I thought that was just for, he goes, oh yeah. He goes, we do it all the time. And there's, you know, the musical composition and arrangement category that I would like to submit this in if you would allow me to do that. I'm like, yeah. So the first time, you know, I submitted, I got nominated. And it was unbelievably exciting. I spent $1,000 on a dress. Because I thought, this is the only time I'm ever going to ever do this, so I better look good doing it. And so I didn't win, but so that was sort of sad, but it wasn't. I mean, because to me, it was like, to be nominated was just hitting it out of the ballpark.
Yeah.
But then he and his team asked me if they could use the recorded music, the things that you and I did together, for background music for the documentary series that they were just starting called Great Colorado Women. And they were stories, short documentaries that they're 26 minutes long and they air on Rocky Mountain PBS. There's 5 seasons now. And they used my music to support, you know, the documentaries. And so I'm in all of those. And so we submitted the next season too. Well, actually, I think the next season, it was a standalone. I did the Tory Gates, and they helped me with a documentary that wasn't related to the hall, and I won. And so that was like, holy moly. And then the next season, we submitted another documentary, and we won that. And then we won another one the next season.
Look at
and
you
it's
go.
Just like, oh, man.
Yeah.
Winning awards, I mean, as cool as it is, it's like that wasn't ever my goal. It wasn't like something that I laid awake when I was a kid at night just going, oh, I wish I could win an award. It wasn't that at all. It was this happy accident that was like, well, cool.
Are you continuing to nurture that route for your music?
I am, as a matter of fact. And unfortunately, the Emmys, the Heartland Emmys, have discontinued the music composition and arrangement category.
Permanently?
It doesn't have to be permanent, yeah. But I don't know. Wow. You know, so this year it doesn't exist. It existed last season, and I was nominated, didn't win, for my cousin Carlotta's documentary, Carlotta Lanier. She was one of the Little Rock Nine integrating schools for the first time in America. And so my music was all throughout that documentary. But that was last season, and that was the last season, and we'll see if they resurrect it or not.
You mentioned the Torrey Gates, and mm-hmm. I think the Torrey Gates is a great story that relates to your skill and art and the event of that earthquake. Will you give me just a little?
It was interesting because I had a student. His name is Parker Geisler, and he was, in my estimation, a genius. Just a genius. He came to me, didn't know where Middle C was, and in, you know, a few months could play Chopin etudes. Just a mind-blowing guy. But he also did some paintings. And so he painted me this painting of Torrey Gates, and they're the sacred gates that sort of stand at the shore, between the shore and a village in Japan, in small cities and towns in Japan, to protect the fishermen. And so they're sacred. And he did a painting of these gates. There was a gentleman in New York that had contacted me. He was actually a fan of Liz's, and he contacted me and wanted us to come out and do a private event for them, which we did. And during that time, we learned about the Torrey Gates and all of this, and I had been composing this song that I was initially going to call Incantation or The Spell or something. It was about magic. But every time I would play it for people would go, oh, it just reminds me of water, lots of water. And it was kind of an unusual thing because usually if I have an idea in my head and I'm playing, composing a piece, and I ask people what it makes them think of, they think of the thing that I thought that it was about, right? So this was really unusual that it wasn't what I thought. So I'm writing this song, and I'm kind of playing it, and I'm hearing about this story about the tsunami that happened in this little town called Hachinohe in Japan. And the tidal wave washed away their Torrey Gates, and they washed up on the shore of Oregon. Actually, a farmer came and found these gates and brought them to the Portland Japanese Gardens, and they wanted to identify them and see if they could take them back. So they formed this whole committee. Caroline Kennedy was part of that committee, and they did. They identified it, found where it went, they shipped it back, and re-erected these Torrey Gates.
Were those gates near the Fukushima disaster?
You mean just the tidal wave?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was all part of that. That was absolutely it. And so they got that all done and everything, and I heard this story, and then Parker gave me this painting, and so all of these sort of elements were sort of converging at once, and I realized that the piece was about the story, the waves and the all of it, you know, and so I was able to finish the song, and I let the gentleman in New York hear it. And I also said, and here's this gigantic picture of the Torrey Gates, and here's a picture of it. Would you like it? Well, yes, he did. We shipped it to him. He took it to Japan. It is in their town hall in Hachinohe, this picture of the Torrey Gates. And so anyway, so that's what the song is about. And they came to the Portland Japanese Gardens, and I did a concert and played for the people of Hachinohe.
You played the Torrey Gates composition?
I did.
What serendipity.
Isn't it?
Isn't that something?
It was just a wild web of unimaginable sort of stuff.
Interestingly, you composed the piece kind of ahead, and it kind of all fell into place and became something.
Well, and here's weirder parts than that. So at that time of the tidal wave, my father was going back to Iwo Jima. He was one of the first African-American to go back to the original battleground. He made two attempts. The first attempt, he couldn't get there because of that tidal wave. And then he eventually went back and actually got to see Iwo Jima and all of that.
Well, that's a very cool story. What do you got coming up? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I am working with Matran Matran Studios in Chicago, and we're mastering, doing a whole new orchestration of The Dragon Within, which is the piece that I played that Denise Gentilini, and you and I know her very well, helped me orchestrate specifically to perform for that event. But I wanted to release this song, this piece, as a single. So what we're doing is we're using the recording that you and I did of the piano and adding the instrumentation, the orchestration to it, and we're almost done. We're at the mastering stages now. I think I'm going to be able to release that single. And it's the first time I've ever released a single. It's the first time I've ever done a real orchestration.
Yeah.
And so at Colorado Women's Hall of Fame, that was the first time I ever played with an orchestration
so
in public.
How did you attach the orchestration to your performance?
So Denise and I worked really hard to figure out how that was going to work because, it's kind of a conundrum. How am I going to be in control of it enough so that I'm feeling comfortable? And we just made it so that I could play the first part of it solo, and then as I cross my hand over, I could use QLab to hit the space button on my computer, and then it starts, right? So I don't have to rely on anybody else. If I make a mistake, I can keep going, or what, you know what I mean? But once it starts, it's going.
You're in.
Yeah.
See, look how your typing has come back to help you.
I know, right?
We are going to listen to Tori Gates right now.
Oh, yay. Thank you.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say that we may not have talked about?
Well, yeah, but I do want to say how much I appreciate you and how well you and I work together. And I'm assuming that you work well with pretty much everybody, but you and I had, it felt to me like we had this really special sort of workflow that just totally worked for me. You understood me, you understood the music, you understood what I wanted, and we were just in our own little world, even though Pete was like there sleeping on the couch or whatever in the studio, it was like you and I were just in our own little world, and I just appreciate that so much. That was some wonderful experiences with you. And just all the loving effort that you put into all of it, from mic placement to what food are we going to have for lunch. I mean, just everything. It was a wonderful experience, three albums with you.
When I think about you and I in the recording studio, I think about you bringing in some pieces with some very challenging sections.
Yeah.
And you'd be playing the piece and you'd get there and, oh, that didn't come out right. And you'd go over and over that little section. And I'd be sitting there, you know, recording, writing down, this take 14, take 15, take 16. And then we would sometimes assemble the piece. But that process of you honing those parts down and nailing those passages, because you really challenge yourself in the studio. You don't come in there and just kind of play simple stuff. You play at the top of your skill level.
I do. And what helped me a lot in the recording process with you is just you being honest with me. Like sometimes like that process that you were just describing of me going over and over and over, and you're like, you sound kind of mad. Maybe we should take a break. Yeah.
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 There's a lot of great things to a relationship between an artist and a technician.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that with you. And again, I learned so much doing it too. It's not like that I was the master or anything here. We learned together.
Well, I got to tell you, I viewed you as the master the whole time. So if you weren't, you fooled me.
Cause I was pretending. Well, great. I loved this.
This was fun.
I love you and your music.
I love you back. This was great.
We hope you're enjoying Studio V, Southern View Sound and Music's podcast series about audio recording and currently featuring discussions about the grand piano. If you would like to learn more about Lisa and her amazing career, visit lisadowning.com. And to learn more about us, visit our website at southernviewsound.com. Thank you for joining us.